ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, tensions rise in the Middle East. Israel has struck back at Iran, and there are now major fears the dangerous conflict will escalate. Also, after operating for nearly 130 years, Broken Hill's famous local newspaper is closing down. And in the small town American high school where Kevin Bacon danced his way to fame 40 years ago, teenagers are getting ready for his big return.
I think it just shows the power of the people and like the power of teenagers. We'll put him in the middle of the dance circle. We're going to make sure he knows all the dances. We're going to test him. There's going to be a quiz after.
First tonight, American media outlets are reporting that an Israeli missile strike hit Iran earlier today. The apparent retaliation comes after Iran attacked Israel for the first time last weekend. Western leaders, including the American President Joe Biden, have been urging Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to exercise restraint. The ABC's Middle East correspondent Alison Horn is in Jerusalem. Alison, what's the latest on these strikes?
Well, it's still quite early in the morning in the Middle East, so the exact details are still coming to light. But we know from US officials, they claim that Israel has attacked Iran with a missile strike. That is different from what Iranian officials are saying. They're quoting that there was no missile attack, that it was a drone attack, that in fact three drones were spotted over Isfahan, which is the central province of Iran, and that there were explosions heard in the sky. But Iran is saying that these explosions was Iran shooting down these drones and that no ground explosions have occurred. So we're getting differing views from across the world on exactly what has happened yet. We haven't heard from Israeli officials, but this is, in any event, an escalation of the situation here. This kind of started coming to a head at the beginning of April when there was an Israeli airstrike on the Iranian consulate in Damascus, where a number of senior military Iranian commanders and officials were killed. After that, Iran promised there would be retaliation, and retaliation there was in the form of more than 300 missiles and drones fired here over Jerusalem, where I am, and the wider Israeli community over the weekend. Most of those missiles and drones were shot down before they made landfall by the by Israel and its defence capabilities, but also in conjunction with the United States and the UK. At the time, the US said that Israel's response was a major win and that Israel should take this as a win and not retaliate to Iran. We see now overnight that that hasn't happened. These attempts to de-escalate what could turn into a wider regional conflict haven't happened. There has been some sort of an attack on Iran overnight, but as I said, we're still getting the details.
So how likely do you think it is that this is going to spark even further escalation?
Well, I think we can't underestimate the fact that we are sitting on the precipice of what could turn into an all-out war between Israel and Iran, drawing in regional partners, including allies of Iran, like Hezbollah in Lebanon and the Houthis in Yemen. What will be important is how Iran publicly responds in the next few hours. If in fact Israel has only targeted military facilities, which is what Isfahan is known for, it has weapons technology, drones, facilities. It also does have nuclear facilities, although there's no suggestions that that's what was being targeted here. If it does turn out that Israel is only targeting those facilities, that will be seen as the lesser end on the spectrum of what kind of retaliation Israel could have conducted into Iran. In any event, though, it still will be seen as an escalation. But I think the fact that we're hearing from Iran that there was, in their words, no ground explosions, no damage, it seems to suggest that they are trying to talk down this attack, which could go to what happens next and the fact that Iran may not be looking towards such a severe retaliatory action.
As you say, this is a developing situation. What, though, can you tell us about the mood in Israel at the moment?
Well, things are tense. The Department of Foreign Affairs in Australia has actually just urged Australians in Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories to leave here if it's safe to do so. We do know, however, that there hasn't been any change to the home front commands in Israel. So, for example, before we had the missile strikes over the weekend, there were a whole heap of restrictions that were put in place, including schooling was banned, all education was shut down, there were caps on the numbers of people who could gather in public places together. None of them have been introduced or talked about now, which could suggest that Israel doesn't expect there to be any immediate response.
Alison, thanks very much for speaking to us, and please take care.
Thank you.
The ABC's Middle East correspondent, Alison Horne, is in Jerusalem. Professor Sharam Akbazadeh is the convener of the Middle East Studies Forum at Deakin University, and I asked him what he thinks will happen next in the conflict between Israel and Iran.
Well, as far as Iran is concerned, Iran was hoping that given that they had to save face and respond to Israel, but giving advance warning to Israel that all their missiles could be intercepted, the matter is dealt with. Iran has saved face and Israel is safe. So Iran was hoping that this would be end of the matter. Now, with another wave, and I suspect there could be more than this one, this seems to be a very small wave, a small attack. There's every chance that there will be more to follow. And that would mean that Iran would be again in a position where it has to respond. So very serious risk of escalation.
Do you think the Israeli retaliation will affect American support for Israel in the ongoing war in Gaza and in the conflict with Iran?
Well, the United States has been a strong ally of Israel from day one. American support for Israel is ironclad, as President Biden said. But the United States is becoming increasingly impatient with Netanyahu's excesses. The Americans don't have any love for Hamas, and they really don't care if Hamas is destroyed. But the fact that something like more than 30,000 in Gaza have lost their lives is a really, really big price to pay for that agenda. So the United States is getting impatient with Netanyahu, but at the end of the day, they don't feel that they can oppose him publicly. So on the public scene, the U.S. will continue supporting Israel, even if it comes to conflict with Iran.
I see the White House has put out a statement this afternoon saying that President Biden's team has again sought to put the brakes on Israeli plans for a major military assault on the southern Gaza city of Rafah. And they say that has prompted the Israelis to agree to rethink their approach and come back later for further consultations. Do you think an assault on Rafah by the Israelis is now less likely?
I think it's actually more likely, given that attention has not turned away from Gaza and everyone's focusing on Israel-Iran conflict. Israel seems to have a free hand in Gaza. Only yesterday, Netanyahu announced plans for new settlements in Gaza. So I suspect that the Israeli government is quite happy for the world attention to be turned away from Gaza and give them that opportunity to pursue their agenda of destroying Hamas, which is really high in the sky. I don't see how you can destroy a militant organization that has emerged out of the experience of being under Israeli occupation.
Has Israel got the capacity to wage war against both Hamas and Iran?
Well, the Israeli Armed Forces, IDF, is quite capable. It's very modern, but it's not alone. IDF has the support of the United States, and when push comes to shove, as we observe when Iran sent missiles and drones to Israel, the United States come to Israel's aid, and they can defend themselves. Fighting two battles is a challenge, but I think it's a challenge that the right wing in Israel welcomes.
That's Professor Sharam Akbazadeh from Deakin University. In other developments, the United States has vetoed a United Nations Security Council resolution that could have paved the way for Palestinian statehood and full UN membership. While most Security Council members supported the resolution, under the body's rules, a single vote from the US was sufficient to block the resolution, as Nick Grimm reports.
I shall now put the draft resolution to the vote.
140 states around the world recognise Palestinian statehood, and at the gathering of the UN Security Council in New York, the call for those members willing to support UN recognition of Palestine saw 12 hands raised. But then came the next question to be asked.
Those against? Thank you.
And the single vote of the United States was sufficient to scupper the resolution, as explained by Malta's permanent representative to the UN, Vanessa Frazier.
The draft resolution has not been adopted owing to the negative vote of a permanent member of the Council.
The United Kingdom and Switzerland abstained from the vote, while among those supporting the resolution were France, Japan and South Korea, all staunch US allies. But on this issue, they're sharply at odds.
We also have long been clear that premature actions here in New York, even with the best intentions, will not achieve statehood for the Palestinian people.
That's the United States representative to the UN, Robert Wood.
This vote does not reflect opposition to Palestinian statehood, but instead is an acknowledgement that it will only come from direct negotiations between the parties.
The Security Council must recommend the admission of new UN members to the organisation's 193-member General Assembly, where votes are carried by a simple majority with no members holding veto powers. As such, supporters of Palestinian statehood hold high expectations of winning a General Assembly vote if it were ever to be held. The Palestinian UN envoy Riyad Mansour telling the Security Council,
our right to self-determination is a natural right, a historic right, a legal right, a right to live in our homeland, Palestine, as an independent state that is free and that is sovereign.
I wish to begin by thanking the United States.
The Israeli ambassador to the UN, Gilad Erdan, there, 6 months after the October 7 attack by Hamas. He accused members of the Security Council of seeking to reward the perpetrators of atrocities with statehood.
Most of you, sadly, decided to reward Palestinian terror with Palestinian state. I pray that the day will come and you will understand the magnitude of the mistake that you are making here.
While Britain abstained from the vote, its representative, Barbara Woodward, told the forum that Palestinian statehood must wait.
We must start with fixing the immediate crisis in Gaza, ensuring Hamas is no longer in charge of Gaza, and removing Hamas' capacity to launch attacks against Israel are essential and unavoidable steps on the road to lasting peace.
But there's still no end in sight to that road. Gaza's health ministry says Israel's military offensive has now killed over 32,000 Palestinians.
Nick Grimm reporting. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Ahead, Broken Hills newspaper closing down after 130 years. The world's biggest election is underway in India, with nearly 1 billion people eligible to vote over the next 6 weeks. The Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, is expected to have a resounding win, giving him a rare third term in office, but he may face some strong opposition in some parts of the country. The ABC's South Asia correspondent, Meghna Bali, reports on this massive electoral operation from Chennai. Meghna, what's involved in conducting this massive election?
Yes, Sam, it's a huge logistical task given the sheer numbers involved. You're talking 1 billion voters, 2,600 parties, 5.5 million voting machines, and they need to get from the Himalayan peaks to the tropical Andaman Islands in the south. I'm standing outside a polling station in the southern city of Chennai, and there have been massive crowds of voters here since polling booths opened a few hours ago at 7 o'clock. And it's especially impressive because it is so hot out here. It's 36 degrees. And I've spoken with first-time voters, the elderly, you know, they've all been telling me about how important they consider their right to vote. And they've been talking to me about jobs and employment and what they think about the government, and they haven't been shy at all. And we know that's how the majority of Indians feel across the country. Like, voter turnouts tend to sit around the 70% mark. So it just goes to show how keen they are. And it's considered a bit of a festival here, which has been really exciting to see. And this election is going to happen in 7 phases across 6 weeks. Today marks the first phase, and it'll end on June the 1st, with results out around June 4th.
So I understand Narendra Modi is the hot favourite to be re-elected. What's his pitch to voters?
Yeah, look, Mr. Modi's starting from a very solid foundation. He's been in power for 10 years. His first pitch in 2014 was about hope. His second one was about trust in 2019. And I think now it's very much forward-looking. So he's made some gains infrastructure-wise across the country. And the perception is that he's done really well when it comes to big projects, transport, science and technology, space missions. This time around, the BJP and Mr. Modi have focused their campaign on development for women, young people, farmers, lifting people up from poverty. And he's made some pretty big promises, including making India the third largest economic power. And from a national security point of view, they want to build better infrastructure on the Indo-China border, and they want to modernize their army. And it's really been working for them, especially in the northern parts of the country, where the party has a really well-organized network of grassroots workers. And of course, the slick marketing and propaganda machine doesn't hurt.
So the southern electorate's going to be a little bit harder for him to do well in, do you think?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. This is the reason we wanted to start our coverage here in the southern state of Tamil Nadu, in the city of Chennai. And that's because Mr. Modi and his allies have set themselves pretty ambitious targets. They want 400 out of 543 lower house seats. That's 2/3 of parliament. And having saturated the north and middle parts of the country, they really need to make gains in the southern part of the country, these 5 states and 2 union territories out here, if they want to try and break that number. And analysts say it's unlikely but not impossible. And that's partly because so far the south has been quite immune to Mr. Modi and the BJP's charms. It's a tough region to crack. And we've seen Mr. Modi during this campaign put massive amounts of efforts to try and appeal to the voters. And that includes, you know, he's been here 10 times since January, announced, promised major infrastructure projects. The mood on the ground so far has been there's quite an anti-BJP sentiment out here. So I think it'll be pretty tough to crack.
And Meghna, who are the opposition parties?
So, look, the opposition right now, there isn't really one main opposition parties. What's actually happened is, in an effort to oust the BJP, around 26 opposition parties have come together under a coalition called India. And that includes the Congress Party, which is, of course, the party that was in power before the BJP. But the problem with this alliance is that it's been undermined by disputes over leadership and seat sharing, and a few party leaders switched over to the BJP. So it's sort of really left them in quite a weakened position.
And is anyone in India raising concerns that this won't be a free and fair election?
Yeah, look, it's been of massive concern over these last few months, and it's really been ramping up. And it's really, this election campaign has been tainted by a few events that have happened in recent weeks. And that includes the arrest of a major opposition leader in Delhi, in what their party says is a conspiracy by Mr. Modi's government to crack down on them. We've seen the freezing of bank accounts of major parties like the Congress Party over tax disputes. And it's really frustrated their ability to campaign around the country. Of course, it's such a costly exercise. So they haven't been able to do that. And there have also been some pretty massive revelations of a heavily skewed political financing scheme that's favoured Mr. Modi's party. So all of these things have got the opposition really questioning the government's intentions. They've also accused Mr. Modi of setting investigating agencies against them and arresting them. So it's left them in a severely weakened position going into this election.
The ABC's South Asia correspondent Meghna Bali in Chennai. The outback New South Wales city of Broken Hill has lost its local newspaper. The Barrier Truth has announced its shock closure after nearly 130 years of operation. The union-run newspaper published its final edition on Wednesday. It's another blow for the mining town after it lost its nightly commercial news service a year ago. And as Gavin Coote reports, locals in the Silver City point out the Barrier Truth was unlike any other regional paper in Australia.
It's a city whose history is steeped in unionism just as much as it is in mining. The birthplace of mining giant BHP, Broken Hill was for decades an industrial powerhouse, and if you wanted work, you had to be in a union.
You don't have to be in Broken Hill very long to realise that the whole town is an extremely highly organised and efficient union camp.
The union-run Barrier Daily Truth newspaper has been an integral part of Broken Hill's story. At the height of the union movement's influence in the city, a subscription to the paper was all but compulsory for local workers.
That means you have to have pay for a copy of the Barrier Truth.
That is correct.
So you had to take a daily paper whether you wanted or not?
Yes. No well, argument about it.
Is that democratic, do you think?
Well, I think it's democratic to this extent. We have to turn around and run a paper, and the truth, when it's all said and done, is 80% of our strength. Because even if a fellow doesn't go to a union meeting, he can read all about the truth.
Robert Williamson was among the thousands of locals who had a subscription, whether they wanted it or not.
And if you come from a family like me where there's four boys and a father, all in the union, so five newspapers came over the fence every morning.
Long gone are the days of compulsory subscription, and the Barrier Truth, after printing more than 33,000 editions, has published its final copy. Robert Williamson, a mining executive who grew up in Broken Hill, had worked hard to stop that from happening almost 4 years ago. His efforts to raise money to keep the paper running during the pandemic were the focus of an Australian Story episode on ABC TV. He now says dwindling subscriptions have made the outcome inevitable.
When the newspaper was successful, it was because it was a union subscription and because the town was over 30,000 people. The town is now about half of that. I think they tried to keep the price of the paper down so it was affordable.
What do you think it means now for Broken Hill to not have a newspaper that sort of projects that sense of local identity?
Well, it's a big loss. It's a sad day. We have in the town of Broken Hill, there is a very large component of retired mine workers that rely on the newspaper. They don't tend to use computers or iPhones. The fact that when you stop a habit, it can actually have an effect on your mental health. And I saw that as not a nice thing to be happening, especially while we had this COVID coming along, which nobody knew how bad that was going to be either. And I didn't want to have a strain on the health services there, so I thought keeping that newspaper going was something. And I think that's what we've got now. We've got the same problem now. We are going to have to find another way to get the local news to the population.
The Silver City lost its commercial television news bulletin a year ago, and the Barrier Truth is just the latest in a long line of newspaper closures across regional Australia. Maureen Clark, a retired teacher and longtime union leader in Broken Hill, is grateful the paper survived as long as it did.
Really, the Barrier Daily Truth was rather unique in the fact that not many other country places in New South or in Australia have got a or had a daily newspaper. So, you know, that was a unique experience. And people could argue, well, how was it ever going to survive, you know, in the time of social media? But, you know, survive it did. And it was, you know, in an isolated community like Broken Hill, it was more important than ever.
From now on, it'll just be the major newspapers from Adelaide and Sydney that Broken Hill locals will be able to read. Maureen Clark is unsure if anything can truly replace the impact of a community newspaper.
Well, it's interesting that, generally speaking, people say, well, what do you need a newspaper for anyway? You've got social media. Social media does not bind a community together like a newspaper does.
The board of the Barrier Truth has described the decision to cease operations as heartbreaking and says it's seeking further legal and financial advice.
Gavin Cooch reporting. Well, if you remember the year 1984, I probably don't need to tell you that's the Oscar-nominated song from the film Footloose. It's hard for many of us to believe, but it's now 40 years since Kevin Bacon cut loose in that film that shot him to fame. And to mark the anniversary, students at the US high school where the movie was filmed have been campaigning to bring the lead actor back for the last school dance or prom there. The teens took to social media, reenacting scenes and staging flash mobs to convince the star to return, and it worked. This report from John Daly.
Students at Payson High School in the US state of Utah weren't even thought of when the iconic movie Footloose was filmed on their campus in 1984. Though 17-year-old Sophie Savage says it's been the pride of their local community ever since.
Because I grew up watching it and my parents love that movie. They were obviously alive when it came out. So it's kind of special to me already. Just looking in the hallways or looking in the town and be like, oh my gosh, I know where that scene is from, or I'm walking the same hallways.
It's the 40th anniversary of the release of Footloose, a musical drama with one of the best-selling soundtracks of all time. Footloose by Kenny Loggins was number one on Australian charts for 3 weeks in 1984. And other hit songs in the movie were Holding Out for a Hero and Let's Hear It for the Boy. The movie also launched Kevin Bacon's acting career. He stars as a city boy named Ren who moves to a conservative small town where dancing is banned. He soon goes on a mission to have that ban overturned, with dreams that he and his high school classmates can hold a prom.
I thought this was a party! Let's dance!
In real life, Payson Senior High School will soon shift to a new location, and the old building that was the backdrop for Footloose will be demolished. The students decided they needed to give the building a proper farewell and also mark the 40th anniversary. And what better way to do that than by luring Kevin Bacon back to Payson for one last prom? They went all in, starting with TikToks reenacting scenes from the movie.
Hey, ladies, check this out.
And before long, it turned into a full-blown campaign called hashtag Bacon to Payson.
We had a Footloose-themed spirit bowl, or we've had Footloose-themed dances, and, you know, social media has been a big, big help with this campaign.
It worked.
What's going on, Payson High School?
Appearing on the Today Show, Kevin Bacon announced to Payson's packed assembly hall that he'll return on the day of the prom.
I'm going to come. I got to come.
Yeah! 16-year-old Lauren Kraut says even though students weren't born when the film came out, they still relate to the message it conveys.
It's so easy for teenagers to like not feel heard in that situation, just feeling like nobody hears what you have to say and all these things. And like Footloose is pretty much all about that. And I think like even this whole thing, like the whole campaign we did and we got Kevin Bacon back to Payson, like it genuinely is a group of high school kids. I think it just shows the power of the people and like the power of teenagers.
Their teacher, Jenny Staley, has been with them every step of the way.
I am beyond proud of these kids. I'm proud of the things that they have pushed themselves to do that made them really uncomfortable. I have just watched them grow exponentially through this process.
As for the famous Footloose dance moves, Lauren Kraut says 65-year-old Kevin Bacon better be ready to cut loose when he shows up on Saturday.
100%. We'll put him in the middle of the dance circle. We're going to make sure he knows all the dances. We're going to test him. There's going to be a quiz after.
That's Payson High School student Lauren Kraut, ending John Daly's story. Bonnie Tyler taking PM out this week. Thanks for your company. I hope you have a great weekend. We'll be back on Monday.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. As the events unfolded at Bondi Junction last Saturday afternoon, an unsuspecting uni student was wrongly named as the killer on the social media platform X, formerly Twitter, and then on Channel 7. So how did the lie take off? Who was originally behind it? And how can we really hold social media giants to account for misinformed and dangerous content? Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.